Chapter 16. The International Medical Congress and some Pasteurian fiascos. It was in the year 1877 that Pasteur took up the subject of anthrax, and, as usual, pushing himself to the front, he promoted far and wide his method of cultivating the rod-like organisms, or bacteroidea. These he claimed to have proved to be the sole cause of the complaint, which he proposed impressively to rename the disease of the bacteroidea. He asserted that the blood of an anthracist animal contains no other organisms but the bacteroidea, which he considered to be exclusively aerobic. He argued that they, therefore, take no part in putrefaction, which, according to him, is always due to anaerobic microorganisms of the order of Vibrios, and that consequently, anthracist blood of itself is imputrescible. In the corpse, on the contrary, he believed that anthracist blood quickly becomes putrescent, since, according to him, every corpse provides a home for Vibrios which enter from without into the intestinal canal, always fuel of Vibrios of all kinds, and so soon as the normal life does not hinder them they bring about a prompt disintegration. This was the teaching upon which Pasteur was to build up his prophylaxis against anthrax, and so, for his prophylactic, he put forward a mixture of aerobic germs, namely, the bacteroidea, with anaerobic germs, of putrefaction. He maintained that a result would be obtained that should neutralize the virulence of the Bacillus anthracis, and thus if injected into animals would protect them from infection. It was while Pasteur was putting forward such views that he fell foul of another member of the Academy of Medicine, Dr. Collin, who asked how anthrax could be due to the bacteroidea when it was sometimes found in a virulent stage, and yet without the presence of these microorganisms. He claimed the floor on 12 March 1878, to criticize the printed report of the former session. He said, "Monsieur Pasteur, at the previous session, had formulated two propositions, which are not to be found in the bulletin. The first is that the bacteroidea of anthrax do not develop in the blood of healthy animals, the second is that the bacteroidea will not supply germs to the organism. I replied that these two allegations seem to me open to dispute, but all criticism of them becomes pointless, owing to their suppression from the printed record. Other statements of Pasteur have also been suppressed from the record, for example, it would take a man his lifetime to examine a drop of anthracist blood, and also that, the search for a bacteroidium in a drop of blood is as difficult as that for a cell of a ferment in a liter of beer yeast. These suppressions, and some additions of which I need not speak, are absolutely a matter of indifference to me, although they make me appear as having spoken, in the air, and without object. But what is not indifferent to me is that M. Pasteur represents me in the bulletin as saying something I did not say, inserting as mine a mode of experimentation and of reasoning that is not mine at all. It is against this that I protest." Pasteur gave a confused reply, which did not answer Dr. Collin's accusation, which, be it noted, did not concern the natural correction by an author of the report of his observations, but a direct alteration of the records. In the absence of any proper explanation and apology from M. Pasteur, we can quite understand Dr. Collin saying, "Henceforth I will have no discussion with M. Pasteur." The glowing panegyrics that now surround the memory of Pasteur considerably obscure the disfavor in which his methods were held by many of his contemporaries. Pasteur lost no time in pushing his views on anthrax and kindred subjects, and on 30 April 1878, read before the Academy of Science a memoir bearing his own name and those of Messieurs Joubert and Chamberlain. It was entitled The Theory of Germs and Their Application to Medicine and Surgery, and was the first trumpet blast of the germ theory of disease. Pasteur seized this opportunity to advertise widely that he had discovered the fact that ferments are living beings. It goes without saying that not one word of acknowledgement was made to Bechamp for his illumination of the subject. The memoir began by asserting that this discovery was a result of Pasteur's communication in 1857-1858 on fermentation, that the germs of microorganisms abound everywhere, that the theory of spontaneous generation was thus shown to be a chimera, and that wine, beer, vinegar, blood, urine and all the liquids of the body undergo none of their ordinary changes in contact with pure air. We have already seen, firstly, that with regard to fermentation in general and vinous fermentation in particular, and also in regard to silkworm diseases, it is impossible to deny that Pasteur plagiarized Bechamp. Secondly, we have seen that Pasteur's experiments were insufficient to defeat the theory of spontaneous generation, and that they never satisfied sponte parists such as Pouchet, Le Bon and Bastian. Bechamp's experiments and explanations alone seem to account for phenomena that without them can only be explained by heterogenesis. Thirdly, notwithstanding the assertions of this memoir of triple authorship, both the liquids and solids of animal and vegetable bodies do undergo changes because, Bechamp explained, of the infinitesimal living organisms they contain, to which he gave the illuminating name of microzyma. Even Pasteur hinted at belief in this when he claimed that every being, every organ, every cell that lives or continues its life without the help of the oxygen of the air, must possess the character of a ferment. His own self-styled, famous experiment on meat actually bore witness to such changes, although he denied them. The authors of the memoir went on to describe how, in their judgment, an infinitesimal quantity of their last produced culture was capable of producing anthrax with all its symptoms. On sowing their septic product, vibrios obtained from the carcass of an animal that had died of septicemia, the authors found that their first efforts failed. Their cultures were not barren, but the organisms obtained were not the septic vibrios, but had the common form of chaplets of small spherical grains, exceedingly minute and not virulent. Similar observations had already been made by Professor Bechamp, who, with his collaborators, had demonstrated the connection between a disturbed state of body and the disturbed state of its indwelling particles, which, upon an unfavorable alteration in their surroundings, are hampered in their normal multiplication as healthy microzymas and are consequently prone to develop into organisms of varied shape, known as bacteria. Upon an improvement in their environment, the bacteria, according to Bechamp's view, may through a process of devolution return to their microzymian state, but much smaller and more numerous than they were originally. It is regrettable that expositions by Bechamp should have been set aside, especially as Pasteur and his friends could only account for the phenomena described in the memoir by concluding that they had introduced an unobserved impurity at the same time as the septic vibrio. They also stated that each microorganism of a particular form and shape was a disease-causing agent. Thus, according to them, the septic vibrio produced septicemia, and the rod-shaped bacterium, usually associated with anthrax and since known as the Bacillus anthracis, was the direct originator of that torment of animals. They made, in addition, the dogmatic claim that their proof was not open to dispute, although in their theory confusion reigned until the German, Dr. Robert Koch, came to their rescue and formulated a set of rules for the recognition of supposed disease germs. According to him, these must be: first, found in every case of the disease. Second, never found apart from the disease. Third, capable of culture outside the body. Fourth, capable of producing by injection the same disease as that undergone by the body from which they were taken. Here we see the basic theory of the airborne disease germ doctrine contradicted by the last postulate. For if to invoke disease, organisms require to be taken from bodies, either directly or else intermediately through cultures, what evidence is adduced of the responsibility of invaders from the atmosphere? As Bechamp showed, in all the experiments of recent years, it has been the microzyma proper to an animal and not a germ of the air that has been found to be the seat of the virulence. No one has ever been able to produce with germs obtained from the atmosphere any of the so-called parasitic diseases. Whenever, by inoculation, a typical known malady has been reproduced, it has been necessary to go and take the supposed parasite from a sick animal. Thus, to inoculate tuberculosis, the tubercle has to be taken from a subject already affected. It is noteworthy that neither Pasteur nor any of his successors have ever induced a complaint by the inoculation of airborne bacteria, but only by injections from bodily sources. Furthermore, the verdict of time is pronouncing firmly against the microbian rules, and even medical orthodoxy has reluctantly had to acknowledge that Koch's postulates are rarely, if ever, complied with. But Pasteur, as we have seen, had never shown any interest in speculative theories, which were so all-engrossing in themselves to a student of nature such as Bechamp. That is to say, Pasteur's mind always turned quickly to the business side of any proposition. He recognized the possibility of great profit, and dreamed of a means of arresting, or professing to arrest, the ravages of anthrax among sheep and cattle. Using his classification of aerobic and anaerobic microorganisms, he proposed by a mixture of the two sorts to neutralize the virulence of the bacteridium. We have already seen how he regarded the accidental administration of some stale culture to hens as a guide to his subsequent proceedings, and it was for chicken cholera that he first endeavored to procure what he called a vaccine. Professor Toussaint, of the Toulouse Veterinary School, worked on vaccination against anthrax, which Pasteur subsequently took up, and announced himself satisfied that he had discovered a real preventive. In May 1881, Pasteur was invited to put his vaccine to the test at a farm near Melun, and in June he wrote home triumphantly that complete success had resulted. By this was meant that sheep that had been first inoculated with his preparation did not succumb to a subsequent dosage of poison. The test was artificial. No real success could be proved unless it was found that natural infection was powerless against inoculated animals. This objection was put forward, and in July, some experiments were undertaken that were supposed to satisfy it. The power of the vaccine was to be tested by a subsequent injection of blood taken from a sheep that had actually died of anthrax. But here again it is obvious that the procedure was distinct from natural infection, especially as certain sheep remained impervious to the complaint although feeding on ground supposed to be pervaded by bacteria from the buried carcasses of diseased sheep. However, success seemed sufficient for a commercial asset to be made of the supposed prophylactic. It does not take much observation to note that pecuniary profits obstruct unbiased criticism, and thus real investigation was checked from the first by Pasteur's alliance of science with commercialism. In the midst of his experiments, a break came. An international medical congress took place in London in August 1881, and the French Republic sent Pasteur as its representative. His son-in-law tells us of the outburst of cheering that arose as he approached the platform after entering St. James's Hall. While quietly seated in his place amidst the great assembly, unnoticed for the most part, was the real discoverer of the fermentative role of microorganisms of the air and of the internal tissues, the real elucidator of the mysteries of silkworm diseases and vinous fermentation, the founder of views considered to be new even today by cytologists. Bechamp watched the triumph of his rival in silence. In a foreign assembly he would have been the last to cast any stigma upon a compatriot, and it never entered his head that Pasteur would go out of his way to attack him in the presence of strangers. But unhappily, ambition was to trump common decency. The incident took place at a sectional meeting at which Professor Bastian put forward his view of the development of microorganisms in internal tissues, his opinion differing from Bechamp's in that, instead of acknowledging living granulations, the microzymas, as parent units, it involved the spontaneous generation of organic from inorganic matter. Pasteur, called upon to answer, went off on a tangent to the subject, and to refute Bastian, described a cruel experiment which in itself contradicts his apologist's attempts to whitewash his callousness towards animal suffering. The Times of 8 August 1881 quotes his words as follows. If Dr. Bastian took the limb of a living animal, healthy or ill, provided the illness was not microbian, bruised the tissues of it and reduced it to a most unhealthy condition, without, however, breaking the skin, and taking care to exclude microbes from the intestinal canal, he would never find in it the smallest microscopic organisms. Had Dr. Bastian forgotten his Pasteur's experiment of 1863 by which he had shown that the blood and urine of a living animal introduced into glass vases could not putrefy, although exposed to free contact with the air, and with air, moreover, which was constantly renewed, provided only the air was free of germs. In the study of microscopic organisms, there was an ever-present source of error in the introduction of foreign germs, in spite of the precautions that might be taken against them. When the observer saw first one organism and afterwards a different one, he was prone to conclude that the first organisms had undergone a change. Yet this might be a pure illusion. The transformation of a Bacillus anthracis into a micrococcus did not exist. Alas for Pasteur and the verdict of time upon a scientist. That same newspaper, The Times, which quoted his glib assertion, many years later, on 8 April 1914, related the contradictory testimony of a worker at the Pasteur Institute. Madame Henry's discovery marks a step in the evolution of the science of bacteriology. Briefly stated, what has been accomplished is the transformation of a well-known bacillus of definite shape and possessing definite toxic properties into another type of microorganism apparently possessed of properties of a kind entirely different from those of the original anthrax bacillus. Or, as the Daily News of the same date put it, the experiment was made with the anthrax bacillus, which from a rod shape was transformed into a spherical coccus. So much for Pasteur's assertion that the transformation of a Bacillus anthracis into a micrococcus does not exist. As to the newness of Madame Henry's discovery, Professor Bechamp could have explained it at the Medical Congress in the year 1881, when he was already familiar with the transformation of bacilli, both as regards form and function. The Times said, "This discovery, Madame Henry's, is regarded as important and possibly marking a step towards finding some protoplasmic form of the origin of life. This form would appear to be the minute granulations of cells of which Professor Minchin was to speak a year later before the British Association for the Advancement of Science, and which had already been investigated by Beauchamp since the 1860s. We can imagine the trial it was to him to listen to assertions made by Pasteur upon matters that he could so easily have refuted. But, as he tells us in the preface to Les Microzymas, I let him talk, because I was to speak after him." This was when Pasteur, most unfairly, suddenly included his compatriot in his strictures against Sponte Perists, speaking as though Beauchamp were a believer in heterogenesis, instead of the real destroyer of the belief in spontaneous generation through his microzymian explanation of the presence of microorganisms within internal organs and tissues. The Times thus quotes Pasteur: "The same error was made in this respect by Dr. Bastian in England and Professor Beauchamp in France. The latter was wholly mistaken, for instance, in his theory as to the existence of microzymas in chalk." The Times, kind to the fashionable demagogue, leaves Pasteur's criticism at this, but what fired Beauchamp's indignation was, as he tells us in the preface to Les Microzymas, Pasteur's subsequent unpardonable accusation of plagiarism. If there was anything exact in Beauchamp's viewpoint, he had conceived it in assimilating Pasteur's labors and modifying his ideas according to the others. Such a barefaced reversal of facts was too much for long-suffering Professor Beauchamp. He sprang from his seat and faced his traducer, indignantly demanding proofs and promising that he himself would supply proof to establish the exact opposite. Pasteur's behavior cannot, we think, be condoned by even his most enthusiastic admirer. Confronted by his victim, he simply turned on his heel and quitted the assembly, defrauding Beauchamp of any opportunity for a proper public vindication of himself and his discoveries. As the Times has quoted the latter's speech, we can see for ourselves the contrast of the professor's magnanimous and dignified treatment of Pasteur. Professor Beauchamp of Lille, likewise speaking in French, affirmed that the microzymas in chalk did exist, and that if Pasteur had not obtained such results, it was because his experiments were badly conducted. On other points also, Beauchamp contested Pasteur's views. He held that the cause of disease and of death lay in the animal itself. The so-called molecular granulations of histologists were living organized things, endowed with chemical gravity, and having the same functions as the similar granulations which existed in the air and in chalk under the name of microzymas. They were the primitive agents of the organization and the chemical activity of living organisms. Though, strange to say, these microzymas, while morphologically identical, performed different functions in different organic centers and tissues, e.g. the microzymas of the pancreas compared with those of the liver. He could not admit that they entered the tissues from the air. Pasteur denied their existence there because it conflicted with his theories. For his own part, however, he was convinced that tissues did show bacteria of different shapes and sizes where no penetration of germs from the air could have occurred. In Pasteur's experiment with blood and urine, these liquids really underwent a change, and, far from disproving the existence of microzymas in them, served to confirm it. Pasteur was spared the difficulty of replying, since he had already withdrawn after his uncalled-for attack upon the fellow countryman to whose researches he owed such a vast debt. Possibly it was this very fact that envenomed him against Beauchamp. We are reminded of the story of the man who, upon being told that a neighbor detested him, asked, "Why should he? I have never done him a good turn." Lionized by the elite among whom he found himself, Pasteur felt secure in his triumph. At one of the great general meetings, at the request of the president, Sir James Paget, he gave a lecture on his method of vaccination against chicken cholera and anthrax, for which he naturally claimed unmitigated success, while he took the opportunity to extol Edward Jenner, relegating himself and his own works to what was certainly very suitable company. Delighting almost childishly in the flatteries that had been showered upon him, announcing his triumph in private letters, Pasteur returned to France, where a fresh honor soon overjoyed him, his election to the French Academy. He had grown so accustomed to riding down like a juggernaut any contradictions or dissent that dared to show itself that it was very galling to him when, about this time, his triumphal progress met with obstructions from abroad. His biographer tells us that the sharpest attacks came from Germany. Dr. Koch and others disputed Pasteur's conclusions and dared to doubt the efficacy of his prophylactic against anthrax. At home, too, there were annoyances. At the Academy of Medicine, voices were raised against the germ theory of disease, and in particular M. Peter ridiculed Pasteur's all-conquering microbe. It was easy for him to do this, as in March 1882 the reputation of the vaccine for anthrax had met with a disastrous downfall. It had come about in this way. In Italy it had been thought worthwhile for a commission composed of members of the University of Turin to perform experiments such as Pasteur had described, and thus test his prophylactic. As a result, to quote René Valéry Radot, all the sheep, vaccinated and unvaccinated, had succumbed subsequently to the inoculation of the blood of a sheep that had died of charbon. No failure could have been more complete. Pasteur wrote for particulars and was informed that the sheep which had been used for the experiment had died of anthrax on the 22nd of March 1882, and that the following day its blood had been inoculated into other sheep, every one of which died as a consequence. According to Pasteur's theories, this should not have happened, for in a communication on the subject to the Academy of Medicine on the 17th of July 1877, he had maintained that blood from the heart would not be virulent, even though taken from an animal already putrid and virulent in many extensive parts of its body. Pasteur tried to wriggle out of the dilemma by denying that this applied to an animal that had been dead for 24 hours. He claimed that the catastrophe was due to a mistake on the part of the Turin professors, who had inoculated blood that had been septic, as well as tainted by anthrax. The eminent Italians, men of excellent standing, were naturally very indignant at his accusation that they did not know how to recognize septicemia and that a man, who was, by the way, neither a doctor nor a veterinary surgeon, should consider himself able from Paris to diagnose conditions in an animal on which he had never set eyes. For a year a battle royal waged hotly between the Turin Veterinary School and Pasteur, who, finally, in the spring of 1883, wrote and offered to go to Turin and personally repeat the experiment in which the professors had failed so thoroughly and show that the blood of an anthracist carcass would be also septic on the second day after death. But Pasteur was now dealing with men of the race of Machiavelli. These Italians at once saw how easy it would be to make such an experiment appear to succeed by some trickery. They were determined to safeguard its repetition under exactly similar conditions to their own disastrous trial. They therefore replied to Pasteur that, as a condition of the acceptance of his offer, he should first give some precision to his proposed experiments by informing them, first, what, in his opinion, would be the microscopic characters presented by the blood of a sheep, taken directly from the heart, when it is at the time septic and anthracist. Second, what, in his opinion, would be the genus and course of disease, and what would be the macroscopic and microscopic changes that should be expected to be found in sheep and in horned cattle made ill and even killed by the inoculation of this blood. Such experiments, in the opinion of the professors, would be necessary to complete those proposed by Pasteur. Pasteur was not dealing with fools. He was asked to set down in writing definite descriptive statements, which would be tested against hard facts and run the grave risk of being found wanting. This reasonable test of his views, which any scientist should have welcomed, was to him a trap into which he had no intention of walking. The only chance of escape lay in throwing the onus on the Italians, and in a communication to the Academy of Science he actually dared to say, "The Commission of Turin then does not accept my offer to go to them." He was careful to keep from the Academy the letter he had received in which his suggestion was by no means declined, but merely made accessory to preliminary and clear statements in regard to the proposed experimentation. What Pasteur, however, did not hesitate to do was to accuse the Commission of erroneous statements and quotations. His biographer is careful to avoid telling us that he was promptly challenged to point these out. He did so by quoting an extract the commission had taken from his own statement of the 17th of July 1877, in which he had said, "The blood from the heart will not be at all virulent, although it be taken from an animal already putrid and virulent, in several extensive parts of the body." To this he made retort, "I have never written anything of the sort with regard to an animal that has been dead 24 hours." He went on to quote his own version of what he had said, concluding with, "The blood will not be at all virulent, although it be taken from an animal already putrid in several parts of its body." The commissioners, having the text of his communication of 1877 before them, were able to reply that Pasteur, in quoting himself, had omitted the words "and virulent after putrid and extensive before parts," thus manipulating his own statement. They published this communication of Pasteur's together with their own criticism in a pamphlet entitled Of the Scientific Dogmatism of the Illustrious Professor Pasteur, which was published on 10 June and translated into French in August 1883, and bore the signatures of Vallada, Bossi, Brazosco, Longo, DeMarchi and Venuta, all men of high character and reputation. In this document, it was pointed out that Pasteur seemed to have forgotten that the putrid decomposition of bodies might vary in rapidity according to the temperature of March, a month notably changeable in its climatic relation to time and place. The professors now explained that they had regarded Pasteur's offer as a trick and that, not being the fools he had taken them for, they had decided that they must know what he understood by the term septicemia, and that the experiments should be made fully and under the conditions and in the way that they had followed in their own experiment of March 1882. With cutting irony, the commission rejoiced with their illustrious opponent for having at last admitted that the inoculation of blood at once anthracist and septic could, according to the relations of the two taints in the blood doubly infected, produce sometimes pure anthrax, sometimes pure septicemia, and sometimes anthrax and septicemia combined. By this admission he destroyed his own dogma of the non-development of the bacillus of anthrax when it is associated with other organisms, aerobic or anaerobic. The commission further congratulated themselves on having convinced Pasteur that he could not at Paris diagnose the complaint of an animal that had died at Turin, and they were glad that they had caused him to review his dogmas through the researches of his assistant, Roux, and to recognize as erroneous the following principle laid down in his communication of July 1877. The bacteria of anthrax may be profusely introduced into an animal without giving it anthrax. It will be sufficient if the bacteridia suspended in the liquid have at the same time the common bacteria associated with them. The commission pointed out that Pasteur's assertion that the blood of an anthracist carcass would be septic after 24 hours was as much as to describe septicemia as a necessary consequence of the progress of putrefaction, reasoning they considered narrow and inconsistent with facts. They compared various statements of Pasteur's taken from his communication of July 1877 and from his memoir of 1878 on the theory of germs and their application to medicine and surgery. He had stated, "The blood of an anthracist animal contains no other organisms than the bacteridia, but the bacteridia are exclusively aerobic. They therefore take no part in the putrefaction. Thus the anthracist blood is not capable of putrefaction by itself. But in the carcass things happen differently. The anthracist blood enters rapidly into putrefaction, because all corpses give a home to vibrios coming from without, that is to say, in the present case, from the intestinal canal, which is always filled up with all kinds of vibrios. The septic vibrio is none other than one of the vibrios of putrefaction." After asking himself whether septicemia or putrefaction in a living subject is a special disease, he answers, "No. So many vibrios, so many different septicemias, benign or malignant." Yet in his memoir on the germ theory, he asserts, "We have only met one single vibrio in septicemia, properly so called, which the media in which they are cultivated cause to change in appearance, as regards facility of propagation and of virulence." After many other quotations, the commission summed up that it was clearly to be deduced that, according to the illustrious Pasteur, the blood of anthracist carcasses must be necessarily and fatally septic in 24 hours or less, because it contains the vibrios of putrefaction. They sarcastically referred to his admission of septicemias benign and malignant. "But it seems that the vibrios of the benign septicemias reside in Paris only and that in Italy they do not exist, because he has declared positively that the unfortunate animals which died as a result of our former experiment on the 23rd of March were killed by septicemia, which having succeeded in killing must, without doubt, belong to the category of the malignant." Notwithstanding the competence of the illustrious Monsieur Pasteur in such an argument, we venture to differ from him, and, to show that our opinion is correct, we will say in a few words that some of our experiments have proved that even in Turin there are vibrios of benign septicemia, that is to say, of septicemia that is not fatal, and they have further proved that the blood of sheep and horned cattle suffering from anthrax, the blood of the latter not anthracist, the juice of the flesh a prey to putrefaction, containing septic vibrios in the sense understood by Pasteur, may sometimes produce neither pure anthrax nor pure septicemia, nor anthrax and septicemia combined. and that such negative result may be obtained even when the blood contains millions of the vibrios that Pasteur regards as septic, and when these are in very active movement. The pamphlet then describes the commission's experiment in full detail, showing how lowered conditions of temperature, etc., must have retarded putrefaction and that, according to Pasteur's own dogmas, it was certain that there were neither vibrios of putrefaction nor other evidence of septicemia in the blood inoculated into our animals, vaccinated or non-vaccinated. But suppose that there had been the vibrios of septicemia and that neither we nor other competent persons had perceived them, what then ought to have happened according to the dogmas proclaimed by Pasteur in 1877? Either the little droplet or two, spread out in a thin layer upon the wound of each animal and exposed to the action of air, would become harmless as a septic agent of infection, because the vibrios, thronging the septic fluid in the form of moving threads, were destroyed and disappeared on contact with the air, since it was said that air seems to burn the vibrios. But in this case the Bacillus anthracis ought to be able to develop easily, as, being aerobic, it would not have to struggle, on contact with the air, with anaerobic vibrios. Or, alternatively, the vibrios are not destroyed on contact with the air and in this second case, there would necessarily develop in the inoculated animals a malady that in its course, duration, symptoms and lesions would exhibit characteristics of septicemia and septicemia only. But in such a case, lesions of septicemia and not of anthrax should be found in the carcass. Even admitted as a hypothesis that the blood of the anthracis sheep which we employed on the 23rd of March had also been septic, but that we in our crass ignorance and incapacity were unable to perceive it, nevertheless it could not have produced in the animal, inoculated in the way that we have described, anything but pure anthrax. This result, which before the new experiments of Roux was passionately contested by Pasteur because he thought it improbable, is today admitted to be possible, because it does not find itself any more in contradiction with the new dogma, reformed in accordance with the new results of experiments of the month of May 1883, which he has communicated to the Academy of Science in Paris. The pamphlet winds up by showing that the quotations of the commission had been accurately given, and that it was Pasteur who had suppressed certain words to modify his original assertion. Moreover, although he had asked the commission to correct the faults in the French translation of their Italian report, he actually published this in the Revue Scientifique without paying the slightest attention to the all too numerous corrections of mistakes that put a totally different construction upon the original signification. Perhaps it is not a surprise that while the Turin controversy was raging, his son-in-law should put on record that Pasteur was tired of incessant and barren struggles. The Italian professors, however, did not consider their time to have been wasted. On the contrary, they declared themselves satisfied, because we have attained our proposed end, the research and demonstration of truth and the refutation of error. It is only to be regretted that this attitude of scientific doubt should have given way to the simple credulity, the unquestioning faith, of modern medical orthodoxy towards almost any dogma enunciated by the followers of Pasteur. It did not require much perspicacity to realize that if Pasteurian treatment could secure any appearance of success, the pecuniary advantages would be considerable. Thus Pasteur inaugurated the era that was to see the prostitution of science to commercialism. Bacteriological institutes for experimentation upon living animals and for the production and sale of vaccines and sera came into being all over the world, modeled upon the one opened in 1888 in Paris. Odessa was one of the places provided early on with such an institution, but its experience with the anti-anthrax vaccine was calamitous. The vaccine was sent to Kachauka in southern Russia, where it was administered, according to Pasteur's description, to 4,564 sheep, of which number 3,696 were very soon dead. The first vaccinations were performed in August 1888 by Dr. Bardak, commencing on the 8th. 1582 mother sheep were divided into two flocks. One lot was vaccinated before 11 a.m., of which one sheep died within 24 hours and seven others within 36 hours of the operation. The second lot was vaccinated on the evening of 10 August. The first to die succumbed during the night of 9 to 10 August. The greatest mortality occurred on the 10th and 11th. Of the 1582 sheep vaccinated, 1075 died from the effects 68%. Another trial took place at a farm belonging to a man called Spendrianow. The first flock consisted of 1478 sheep of 1, 2 and 3 years of age. The other flock consisted of 1058 sheep, some older than those in the first lot and some younger. The sheep were vaccinated on the 10th of August, between 7 and 11 a.m. The next day, at 1 p.m., the first death took place. The following day the mortality was at its highest and it diminished from August 13. Altogether, out of 4,564 animals vaccinated, 3,696 died, 81%. Thus the Turin disaster is shown to have been by no means an isolated example, and, in answer to pastors' supposed benefactions, these unfortunate animals, had they been given a voice in the matter, would certainly have prayed to be delivered from such a friend. Moreover, Valery Ridot, in his biography of Pasteur, tells us nothing of the private owners in France and elsewhere whom Pasteur had to compensate for animals killed by his vaccine. A special commission in Hungary recommended that the government of that country prohibit its use. Koch and Müller in Germany pronounced against it. The English Board of Agriculture declined to recommend it. While finally, before the last Royal Commission on Vivisection, its protagonists could not do any better than damn the modern, modified, addition with faint praise. Alas for Pasteur and his pronouncement that, the only sovereign judge must be history.